This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Sarah Dingle. Coming up today, Huawei payback. The friend of an Australian man detained for 6 months in China says he's being held in retaliation for Australia locking Huawei out of its new 5G network. A new era, it looks like Boris Johnson is just a few days away from UK prime ministership. So will the EU grant him another Brexit delay? And a state coroner is set to join music lovers at Splendour in the Grass today as part of an inquest into festival deaths. But some have plans regardless. Splendour, do you want
to be mine? Can you give me a rough idea how many pills you might like to take over the course of the Splendour festival?
Six, seven?
That's over the 3 days?
Yeah, not per day.
But first, tensions between Iran and the West have soared overnight after Iran's Revolutionary Guards seized a British tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. It's understood Iran also seized a second Liberian-flagged vessel. It comes just 1 day after an American warship destroyed an Iranian drone in the same waters. Britain says it's urgently seeking information about its tanker, and the US is calling on Iran to come back to the negotiating table, something Iran says it's already done. David Sparks reports.
Iranian state television says the Revolutionary Guards seized the Steno Imperio tanker for not following international maritime regulations. A second tanker, the British-owned Liberian-flagged Mezdar, is also thought to have been seized, although unlike the British-flagged tanker, Iran has not confirmed that. Lord Alan West is a retired admiral in the Royal Navy. He says no one is surprised by the latest development.
Quite clearly, the Iranians are intent on trying to capture a British-flagged ship. They've made that very clear in statements they've made.
The Steno Imperio's owners say they've been unable to contact their vessel, which was carrying 23 personnel. Lord West says he's horrified that UK vessels are travelling in the area unescorted.
And to let one go on its own without an escort, I would have thought was extremely foolhardy. We do, of course, have a problem in that we have far too few escorts in the Royal Navy. The fact we only have one frigate in the Gulf, such an important region, and there's one destroyer on her way out there to relieve her, I think is a terrible indictment of what was a great maritime nation.
Tensions between the UK and Iran flared early this month when British Marines near Gibraltar seized an Iranian tanker, which was suspected of breaking EU sanctions by carrying oil bound for Syria. Iran said it would seize a British tanker in response. And on the 10th of July, according to Britain, Iranian boats harassed a British oil tanker in the region before being warned off by a Royal Navy ship. US President Donald Trump says he's worried about last night's seizures.
So we're going to be speaking with the UK, and this only goes to show what I'm saying about Iran. Trouble, nothing but trouble.
Meanwhile, the US still says one of its warships destroyed an Iranian drone in the region on Thursday, something Iran denies. Holly Dargress is an expert on Middle East relations with the Atlantic Council.
But it seems that this may be, or very likely, arguably, in retaliation of when the British seized an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar on July 4th. The Iranians had come out and said that that was an act of piracy and that they would retaliate in kind. So this seems to be that retaliation that they threatened. These cases are going to probably continue as long as Iran feels that it's getting that economic pressure from sanctions and until the U.S. returns to the Iran nuclear agreement and removes these sanctions. But for the Europeans right now, the remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear agreement, this is very frustrating because they've been trying hard to prevent this nuclear agreement from unraveling, but arguably when you look at these things Iran's doing, it's not very helpful to their cause.
That was Holly DeGrez ending David Sparks' report. All this comes as the UK is just a few short days away from having a new Prime Minister. Both the Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson are competing for Conservative Party leadership, but Boris Johnson is the clear frontrunner. And there are already reports that the EU is preparing to offer the new Prime Minister yet another extension on Brexit. Boris Johnson has also just received endorsement from Donald Trump ahead of the official announcement on Tuesday in the UK, as Samantha Hawley reports from London.
Boris Johnson has held the West London seat of Uxbridge since 2015, but the former London mayor, with his standout signature blonde hair, does not appeal to everyone.
We haven't heard a lot of him.
He's sort of absent, is he?
We did have a bus sign that said, "Where's our MP?" marked on it.
So what sort of, you know, if he's successful and enters
well,
down the street?
Well, it depends whether he gets voted back in. His majority's gone way down, you know.
At the 2017 snap election called by Theresa May, Boris Johnson's majority plummeted. He's now in power with a wafer-thin majority of 5,000 votes. If he enters number 10, that's the smallest margin of any sitting prime minister since the 1920s. A red double-decker bus, number 222, voters are also dismissive of their local member.
Personally, no, I don't think it's a joke.
So not prime ministerial material?
No, I wouldn't have thought so, no.
But the odds are stacked in his favour, and the 160,000 members of the Conservative Party have voted. 97% of them are white, 70% male. If Boris Johnson is announced as the new leader on Tuesday next week, there'll be a seismic shift in the political landscape. He's already being widely compared to Donald Trump.
They both rely on their celebrity a lot. I mean, they both created a public persona and have worked very hard on that.
Sonia Purnell is a Boris Johnson biographer and worked with him during the 1990s when he was a journalist.
They both rather sort of economical with the truth, shall we say, and Boris Johnson has been caught lying many, many times. But again, nothing has really happened to him as a result. It's if morality is not applied to Boris Johnson, just like normal moral standards are not applied to Donald Trump.
She says for the party faithful, all is forgiven because they believe Mr. Johnson will deliver Brexit. Andrew Gimson, another biographer, thinks while there are some similarities between Boris and Donald Trump, there are also many differences.
Boris is much better educated and actually knows several foreign languages and enjoys reading books. And secondly, in my opinion, though not everyone would agree with me, I think he's a much nicer man than Donald Trump.
If successful, he'll be the third leader to be faced with solving Brexit. He'll need to do that by the October the 31st deadline. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for Saturday AM.
Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister has issued a strong statement calling for justice for Australian man Yung Heng Jun, who's been transferred from so-called residential surveillance to criminal detention in China. Mr. Yung has now been detained in China for just over 6 months without access to his family or lawyers. Minister Maurice Payne says the government is concerned for Yung Heng Jun's welfare and state of mind. And if Mr. Yung is being held purely on the basis of his political beliefs, he must be released. A writer by trade, Yung Heng Jun was detained at a Chinese airport in January. Now his friend, UTS Professor Chong Yi Feng, says Mr. Yung has been tortured. Professor Feng says the Chinese government is detaining Mr. Yung in retaliation for Australia banning Huawei from supplying equipment to its 5G network. I spoke with Professor Feng a short time ago and asked him why the Chinese government is targeting Yung Heng Jun.
Yung has been regarded as a political dissident by the Chinese authority. He has published so many internet articles promoting human rights, democracy, and rule of law, which the Chinese authority treated as an offense.
Yung Heng Jun has been moved to a new facility. He's expected to be charged with endangering state security. What is the process now once he has been moved?
It's very, very complicated legal arrangement in China. They have published so many evil laws beyond comprehension in the West. After 6 months of so-called residential surveillance, in which he was supposed to be free, but that was the most terrible period of interrogation and torture. In theory, when he is formally arrested, he should be allowed to have access to a lawyer. But the Chinese authorities can always find excuses. For example, it involves state security, continue to prevent him to meet with lawyer or family members for another 6 months.
And Yang Hengjun, of course, has already spent 6 months being detained without his family or a lawyer having access to him. What do we know about his state of mind? Have you had any communications with anyone close to him?
For the first 5 months, that was the worst period of him. He has been tortured quite badly. The most horrible torture is the he was kept in a cell, a small cell, which two soldiers guard him in three shifts, 24 hours on the clock, with the very strong light facing his eyes, 24 hours. The Chinese authority worried that guys like Yang have mobilization power to provoke popular revolt, like what happened in Hong Kong, what they call color revolution. So they took Yang to prevent, as a preemptive measure, to prevent that sort of social unrest. The second area is to deal with the Australia stand on Huawei. They took Yang as hostage in this case to leverage against Australian government.
He is a bargaining chip in our standoff over Huawei and the 5G network.
Yes, that's they want to use this to send a strong signal.
Professor Chong Yifeng, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was UTS Professor Chong Yifeng. Well, in Indonesia, human rights groups are demanding that Indonesia revoke its blasphemy law after a Christian woman was charged for taking her pet dog into a mosque and creating havoc. The woman has been in custody since last month, despite a diagnosis confirming that she is mentally ill. Rights activists say the blasphemy law is increasingly being abused as a political tool by Islamist groups agitating to impose Sharia law. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
This is the moment caught on video when a Catholic woman entered a mosque south of Jakarta wearing shoes and with her pet dog. Chaos ensued. As Muslims inside asked her to leave, she hit out at one man. Tempers flared, the man began to yell, and the woman then kicked him. She was heard screaming, wrongly, that the mosque was preparing to marry her husband to another woman. The dog was heard barking as it ran wild around the mosque. The woman was later detained and charged with blasphemy because wearing shoes in a mosque is disrespectful and Muslims regard dogs as unclean. But at a police hospital, she was later confirmed to have schizophrenia, which rights groups say should exempt her from prosecution.
It was totally inappropriate, but she has mental condition. Someone like her should not be brought to a court.
Andreas Harsono from Human Rights Watch says Indonesia's blasphemy law is designed to punish offences against any of six official religions. But increasingly, he says, the law is abused by Islamist groups as a political weapon.
The blasphemy law is a tool to pressure whoever against the so-called Islamic Sharia or people whom the Islamists consider to be an easy target. It can be easily used by Islamists to say, look, this is a Christian conspiracy.
In the four decades after the law's enactment in 1965, only eight people were prosecuted for blasphemy. Since 2004, more than 160 people have been convicted, including Jakarta's former governor, who was jailed for insulting the Quran.
It will create more damages inside a society than when this kind of law does not exist. Two-thirds of the world, countries in the world, do not have or do not implement the blasphemy law. Only one-third still.
Andreas Harsono has urged Indonesia's politicians to revoke the blasphemy law, saying other laws are enough to deal with any real crimes committed. But he says political precedent explains why today's leaders are too afraid to act.
Some of them learn from what President Abdurrahman Wahid did about 15 years ago when he tried to act against the Islamists. He had to pay with his presidency.
Human rights groups continue to call for the woman's release. This is Anne Barker in Jakarta for AM.
Well, today, Benjamin Netanyahu will surpass Israel's founding Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion to become the country's longest-serving leader. It's a remarkable achievement in a country where governments rarely last a full term. But Mr. Netanyahu passes this milestone at a time of unprecedented vulnerability, as he faces both a rerun general election and a court hearing on corruption charges. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
As well as being Israel's longest-serving leader, Benjamin Netanyahu could also be considered one of its most divisive. But his supporters and critics can agree on one thing: he's a survivor. Journalist Anshel Pfeffer wrote a biography of the Prime Minister and notes his ability to remove rivals, divide opponents and stay in office.
It's an indication of political success, at least on the domestic level, of winning elections, of commanding coalitions, of holding on in office despite all the rivalry and all the backbiting.
Benjamin Netanyahu's made history in other ways this year. He dissolved the new parliament just 7 weeks after it was elected, after he was unable to form a coalition government, forcing Israel's first election rerun. If he fails to have charges of fraud, bribery and breach of trust dismissed, Mr. Netanyahu could also become the first prime minister to serve under indictment.
Netanyahu believes that he is not just the longest serving Israeli prime minister, but someone who can do things that no one else has done before him and defy all precedent. He'll certainly try and do that, but we're looking at what I think to feel are the twilight of Netanyahu years.
He might be on the ropes, but few Israelis are counting him out. Professor Gideon Rahat from the Israel Democracy Institute says Benjamin Netanyahu has shaped Israel's political landscape around himself.
This would be, a very dramatic development when Netanyahu will step down, because the Israeli system is now built basically on pro-Netanyahu, the anti-Netanyahu parties. This is the main cleavage in Israeli politics, I would say.
But aside from staying in power, it's harder to get Israelis to agree on Benjamin Netanyahu's achievements. He himself lists a strong economy, improved relations with Gulf Arab countries, and an incredibly beneficial relationship with the Trump administration in Washington. Gil Hoffman, the chief political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post newspaper, says Mr. Netanyahu's strategy has been to sideline issues such as the peace process and avoid major conflicts.
The guy hasn't really done anything. He doesn't have a list of things to write home about. But from his point of view, he's got an American embassy moved to Jerusalem. He's gotten America to recognize Israeli control over the Golan Heights. He's gotten America to break the Iran deal. These are things that are very symbolic to the people of Israel.
Benjamin Netanyahu won't have long to enjoy this milestone. He's facing a new election in September and an indictment hearing in October. It's hard to see him surviving both, but the one rule of Israel's fractious and unpredictable politics is never bet against Benjamin Netanyahu. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Torchek reporting for Saturday AM.
Well, back home, a push to increase the New Start allowance by $75 a week will be back on the political agenda when Parliament resumes on Monday. The Greens will introduce the plan and the Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce is supporting the increase, even though the government is yet to budge. Many business groups and economists are also backing the raise. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
In Hobart, Remy Jacobson dreams of being a mechanic. But after losing his casual job, the 22-year-old is getting New Start. It pays $278 a week.
It's good to get your by, but it's a struggle to make ends meet. Like, you can't really. You just struggle half the time.
When you say that you're struggling, how do you afford rent? How do you afford to eat?
I've had a housing house and that just didn't work out. And then after that, I was just homeless for a bit because I couldn't afford to live anywhere really. So I've just been just like staying around and just doing my own thing lately. Yeah.
Where have you been living?
I'm just between my grandparents and just couches really at the moment.
The government is under mounting pressure to increase the New Start allowance by $75 a week. A Deloitte Access Economics report released last year found it would create 12,000 new jobs because those on low incomes tend to spend whatever pay increase they get. Nikki Hutley is a partner at Deloitte Access Economics.
If it's not just a human rights argument that sways them, then let them understand that with a slowing economy, this is actually going to help stimulate the economy. And so you've got that double good outcome.
Melbourne bookshop owner Lisa Lambert believes a New Start increase is the right thing to do, and she also thinks it will bring extra customers.
The price of books hasn't changed in almost 30 years. So in terms of accessibility to people on really tight budgets, they're really good proposition. So we think that it would absolutely help our sales.
In Hobart, Remy Jacobson's job search is hampered by his lack of money.
Well, you've got to be like have your living, like how you are living, sorted before you can get a job. And most of people on Newstart can't afford to do anything like to find themselves on their feet to get a job.
The CEO of the Council of Small Business Organisations Australia, Peter Strawn, is confident that increasing Newstart will help fill jobs in retail and hospitality.
We have a problem at the moment in a lot of industries where it's hard to get a worker. And maybe one of the problems is the people who don't have work at the moment don't have the money to go and seek work. So let's make sure that they've got the resources so they can catch a bus, get the transport they need, buy the clothes they need to go and get a job.
But with a $3.3 billion price tag, the government is yet to be convinced. The cost to the budget bottom line is estimated to be $2 billion.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. Well, most people go to a music festival to hear their favourite artists and soak up the vibes. But some of those at this weekend's Splendour in the Grass may also run into a state coroner. A New South Wales coroner will be heading to Splendour today in the state's far north as part of their investigation into the deaths of six young people who've died at festivals in the last 2 years. And the visit will coincide with a pill testing demonstration. Bronwyn Herbert reports. Do you wanna be mine?
Music festivals are close to a rite of passage for many young Australians, and one of the biggest is Splendour in the Grass, held in parkland north of Byron Bay. Splendour, do you wanna be mine? But big music events like these are in the spotlight, with six deaths at festivals over the past 2 years, leading to a coronial inquiry into drug use and patron safety. The festival deaths have some partygoers taking notice.
I'll tell you, I took stuff last year, but this year I'm not taking anything in or that.
Why is that? Why a change?
Oh, it's just because I don't want to get done, essentially.
It is really scary, you know, when you find out that you've gone to a festival and people that you've gone with have, you know, they've gotten hurt or they've even passed away. And I can see why people have been, Joel, in New South Wales government has been trying to crack down on it. But personally, it hasn't changed my opinion.
Have you taken MDA in the past?
No. We are too scared, especially from the stories and stuff we've heard, and that's just not really our theme.
But for cousins James and Dave from the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, drugs are just part of festival life.
Can you give me a rough idea how many pills you might like to take over the course of the Splendour Festival?
Six, seven.
That's over the 3 days?
Yeah, not per day.
And does it, I mean, we're standing very close to police officers, there's been sniffer dogs here. Does that at all change your awareness or...
More the fear of losing my job.
Deputy State Coroner Harriet Graham will be at the Splendour Festival today. She's expected to attend a pill test demonstration where a legal substance like paracetamol will be tested. It comes as there are renewed calls for pill testing at festivals, along with more evidence-based education campaigns on the dangers of illicit drugs. Promoter of the festival, Jessica DeCrew, says they are fully prepared for any medical issues that might arise.
We have over 30 senior medical staff on ground, including doctors, paramedics, nurses, you know, even the head of a consultant who actually runs emergency services in hospitals. So significant support there. We also have Red Frogs on ground. We have over 450 security.
The inquest into the festival deaths has been extended for another week and will resume in September.
Bronwyn Herbert reporting. Well, Australia's through to the Netball World Cup semi-finals this weekend, but some say at home the code is also the strongest it's ever been. There's been a big effort to develop pathways for young netballers who want to join the professional leagues, and crowd numbers are also strong. That stands in stark contrast to what some teams, like Zimbabwe, have overcome in order to play in this year's World Cup. But some say with the right support, in the not-too-distant future, an African nation could claim the Netball World Cup. Gavin Coote reports.
Remember, have confidence just to let it go.
Hands up now.
On the courts in Sydney's North Shore, Netball World Cup fever has taken hold. Sophie Dixon has every hope of one day turning pro.
Hopefully, like, the dream is to become a diamond, but yeah, we'll see how we go.
Netball is the most popular women's team sport in Australia. Nationally, 1.2 million people, male and female, play netball. And while there's long been a strong pipeline for young talent who want to play for their country, the challenge has been converting this participation to viewership. Former Australian captain Liz Ellis.
But I'd say netball at the moment is in the best position it has ever been in Australia, which is really exciting, and I can't wait to see what the future holds.
Following a thrilling 50-49 win over arch rival New Zealand in Liverpool on Thursday, the Diamonds will now face South Africa in the semi-finals. South Africa is considered one of the strongest teams in the tournament. But it's another African nation that has been viewed by many as a quiet achiever. After an appeal for government funding fell on deaf ears, Zimbabwe managed to crowdfund their journey to the World Cup. With no gym or accommodation available, the women stayed in a local church in the capital Harare during training and made do with what little equipment they had. Sports lawyer Braham Dubcek, who's worked as a consultant to player associations across the world, says the sporting authorities need to overhaul the way money flows through to players.
For nothing else, it would make for a much more interesting competition. I mean, as much as I like to see Australia dominate, it would be much more exciting if, say, a nation like Zimbabwe had beaten Australia and were playing, say, New Zealand in a semi-final. It attracts more interest in the sport, and it spreads the sport across the globe.
Liz Ellis says despite the funding challenges, the rise of African nations in netball is inevitable.
I would love to see an African team challenging for the World Cup, or a couple of African teams at the pointy end challenging in the next 4 to 8 to 12 years.
Australia plays South Africa today at 8:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Gavin Coote reporting. Well, it's been 50 years since mankind first set foot on the moon. And when I say mankind, I mean that literally. In half a century of space missions, only men have ever walked on the moon. Now that's set to change. NASA is planning a new mission with a female astronaut, and Australian women are also keen to get involved. Claudia Long reports.
While the world was glued to their TV screens waiting for Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to step on the moon, for Gillian Schoenborn, July 21st, 1969 was just another day at work.
When an actual man in the moon mission was on, we had a lot of simulations that were leading up to the real event. At the time, I guess we didn't really realise how significant it was because it was our job.
Gillian was a communications operator at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, one of two main Australian ground stations used to beam signals from the Apollo 11 moon landing back to Earth.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Only men set foot on the moon, but Gillian was one of the women on the team bringing that moment to the world.
There were only two women in the communications department at that time, myself and another. We were just one of the group. I didn't feel any different to anybody else.
50 years on from the first moon landing, some things have changed for women in the space industry.
The biggest barrier for the space industry seems to be that initial getting into the space industry. And once you're in, there are so many women.
Rose Tasker is a science communicator and researcher, as well as an aspiring astronaut. She's even undertaken astronaut training in the US.
Zero-G is amazingly addictive.
Women have been going to space for years on various missions, but none have ever been to the moon. But within 5 years, NASA plans to change that.
My name is Badri Yunus. I am the Deputy Associate Administrator with responsibility for all space communication and navigation at NASA.
By 2024, NASA says there'll be another mission to the moon, and this time there will be women on board.
The beauty about our plans and what's going on now is that females and women have come into the workforce with the Apollo 11. We wanted to demonstrate and meet the challenge that was put before us to put a man on the moon. This time, we are going to the moon to explore it.
Just like with Apollo 11, Australia is expected to have some involvement in the Artemis mission.
I'm so grateful to the partnership that we've had so far with Australia. Our relationship goes back 50 to 60 years, and we expect this relationship to continue.
While the Artemis astronauts will be drawn from NASA's Space Corps, the mission is expected to pave the way for further government and private astronaut missions. Aspiring astronauts are already looking at NASA's next stop, Mars.
Claudia Long reporting. And that is Saturday AM for today. I'm Sarah Dingle. Thanks for your company.
Hi, I'm Hagar Cohen. On Background Briefing, Australia's art world on its knees as new questions emerge over significant artworks.
He didn't paint them, so that story's ludicrous.
Are they really painted by the artists we know and love?
He rang me up the very next day and said, you're going to have to get this picture out. The picture's fake, mate.
On Background Briefing.
$1 million bid, $1 million.
Under
bid.
The hammer.
Down goes the hammer and...
Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcast.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.